listening to 10,000 Hours. My name is James Ilgenfritz, and my guest is Nate Woolley.
Thank you.
welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming by. It's great to be playing again. I think that you were probably one of the first people I met here. You know, I remember Andrew D'Angelo had one of his, Andy's Playhouse.
Andy's Playhouse, yeah.
Yeah, I remember what year that was, but that was, I met you and Mike Pride and Jonathan Moritz and a whole bunch of other people that night.
Yeah, I think that was one of the, that was, I had just moved to town too. I hadn't been here very long before that time either, so.
Yeah, it was a night of solos, I remember. Everybody,
oh, yeah.
From that time, so many things have come about. I mean, you've gone from being sort of a newcomer to town. I mean, now I see you've got so many wonderful projects going with people like Paul Litton and Carl Ludwig Hubsch.
Yeah, yeah.
And lots of other things. I don't know. Why don't you tell me about what you do instead of me tell you?
Well, I mean, everything changes. It's such a weird existence in a way. I mean, it really is year to year, and it's interesting to talk about it now because we're just starting a new year, and it's like I haven't really thought about what I'm doing until this week when I've had to deal with it. So I mean, you know, this year is interesting because there's some new stuff playing with people that I've never played with before, and then a lot of kind of keeping certain things going, which I haven't really done before. But I've got a lot this year with Paul Litton, which is that kind of, to me, as far as what I do, is kind of, that's the most important thing to me. I mean, that duo, Paul has always been like a huge influence on my playing. Those early duo records with Evan Parker were always really big to me. And there's, I mean, playing 3 days or 4 nights or whatever with him is really like a pretty profound experience for me. That's one of the things that I'm always happy if I look at the year, at the beginning of the year, like I'm doing now, and I can see that there's, you know, 3 or 4 little things with him that are continuing. We're doing some stuff with Ken Vandermark too, who's someone I've never played with, so that's exciting. And then, yeah, it's a strange year. It's a year of kind of doing scary new things, because the Issue Project Room residency, which I know you're doing too,
right,
is
yeah.
A combination of kind of dealing with projects that have been going on for a long time, like Seven Story Mountain, and taking myself out of my comfort zone by doing a new piece for trumpet and string quartet, written by a Yugoslavian composer that's coming out to premiere it.
Cool.
To kind of trying to rewrite my whole vocabulary in a way, and dealing with a new way of structuring the way that I deal with sounds in a very codified kind of way, in a non-musical way, and presenting that as new solo trumpet music, acoustic trumpet music, which I haven't done in acoustic trumpet solo, like full on, for a couple of years. So that's kind of scaring the crap out of me right now, like without being able to hide behind a giant guitar amp, and really doing things that are really raw on the trumpet and go totally against everything that I've learned up to this point. So that's kind of this year, and that's what I've been up to. And yeah, that's kind of what I'm confronting now as I sit in front of the computer screen and think about what needs to get done every morning.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned this, what you've been doing the last couple of years with the amplified trumpet, and how that's sort of something that lives in a territory that's far removed from traditional trumpet. It's not even just that you're introducing things that are outside of the tradition of jazz or the tradition of classical trumpet, but really that you're making sound in a way that's kind of, you know, it's typically done all through amplifiers, and maybe just, you know, starting with just an effects pedal loop. And
yeah,
even though you're using an instrument that is associated with jazz and different types of free improvised music, but those are usually still acoustic trumpet phenomena. That, I don't know. Why don't you talk a little bit about
the amplifier thing, the history of it is strange for me, but the way I viewed it for a long time, the way that I use it tends to, I think, be thought of more in noise, the noise genre, or like experimental electronic music genre. My main issue with the amplifier for years was, in a way, I wanted to reclaim amplified trumpet. I don't know if I wanted to do it for anybody but me, you know, but I loved, and this is kind of weird because I think that my amplified stuff is about as far away from this as you can get, but I loved the early amplified Miles stuff. Right. And it wasn't because it sounded like a guitar, and it wasn't because it was a rock groove, but it was because, like, that sounded to me like the most honest Miles Davis stuff that he ever did. I mean, it was just super raw and super vocal and wrong and really personal and really uncomfortable. And I love that. And I thought, like, that's what I always thought that music should be. And somewhere along the road, and I think especially when I moved to town, there were a ton of players doing this, it got into a place where an amplified trumpet was something that was mitigated by all these effects pedals and loops, and it was softened up with reverb and all these things. And the people that do that really well, and I think for them it's a really honest expression of what they're trying to do. And it comes out of like years of listening to that kind of music. But to me, I wanted to take it back and put it in that place where it's really raw and loud and uncomfortable and personal. And I mean, my playing has changed acoustically into that more raw and loud and personal and uncomfortable. That's where it feels the most honest to me now. And kind of that, I think, is where it is for me. The amplified thing now also has to go through a change, I think. I'm in a place now where I've played solo amplified enough times that I'm really feeling myself hit the wall of what I can do that's personal on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I feel like I've come to that place where now it's the bag of tricks and I'm going to cycle through, you know, these sounds every night, which strangely is like more successful from the audience perspective. If I know what my sounds are and I put them together in an interesting way, I get a better audience reaction. But I always feel kind of sad when that's over. Like, you know, you only get so many shots to do something like that in your lifetime, to sit in front of people and play solo, which I think that's my favorite thing to do. It's the most personal. And to waste it, like, cycling through your bullshit to me is completely pointless.
Right.
So that's kind of where I am with the amplified music now. As far as the solo stuff, I mean, I use it still playing with like Ryan Sawyer or Spencer Yeh or Chris Corsano or some of those guys, and that's sheerly just an energy thing. You know, they put out so much energy, I'm going to get killed. So the language has to be more of that raw amplified sound than I can get. You know, I'm not a Greg Kelly that can just like cut through that somehow. My sound is not that cutting, or it doesn't have that kind of edge on it. So I mean, it's an interesting, the amplified thing is like everything, I think, to me right now, is just in a state of flux and a state of questioning.
Right.
And you know, always kind of on the precipice of, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to find some other way to deal with it.
I suppose there was a point where getting into that was putting you in that place of searching, and now it's going away from it. A lot of people just are only comfortable being in the area of the uncomfortable,
yeah.
So to speak. You know?
Yeah. You know what? I had a really interesting evening last year talking with John Zorn about a lot of different stuff. And one of the things that he mentioned to me, it was like at a time when I was really dark and kind of needed to talk to him or to talk to anybody, and he's a very good guy about being able to do that.
Yeah.
But one of the things that he mentioned was just that the true test of whether you're doing something right, I think what he explained to me was, I was the kind of person that I'm more excited if the people I'm playing with are surprised at what I played than if the audience gives me a good reaction. So, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of these things, the amp stuff started in a way because I had gone through a lowercase thing where I was very dogmatic about playing very quietly and very spaciously and slow and glacial. And for a lot of different reasons, that wasn't satisfying to me anymore. And one of those reasons was I wasn't surprising the people I was playing with anymore. So out of that comes the amplified stuff. Now the amplified stuff is getting that way where I'm not necessarily feeling like I'm adding anything to the musical landscape. I'm not pushing myself, and people know what to expect. And you know, it's not the path of least resistance, but it's, for me, I've realized that it's kind of the path that keeps me sane, or at least makes me feel like I'm actually doing something, or I'm doing work that is worth doing.
same time, over these last few years, have been having so many records that have been coming out that really highlight your so-called, you know, jazz playing. Harris Eisenstadt's Canada Day Quintet is a pretty highly celebrated group here in New York, with a very set lineup. Your quintet record, I know you just recorded it a couple months ago.
Yeah, I think it'll be out in the spring of 2011. With Harris's thing, I can't really say enough about Harris, because when he moved to town, I was in Canada Day. In fact, I might be the only guy that's been in Canada Day the whole time, until he reached this lineup, which is, like, pretty set. And really, like, I think about it sometimes, and I don't know if it was, like, genius of him to keep me in the band, or, like, lunacy, because of all the people that he's had in there, for the kind of music he's writing, which I think is totally gorgeous, and has a very specific thing. Like, I don't, you know, there are so many trumpet players that could just, like, kill certain sets of changes that he writes, and for me, I always feel like it's more of a struggle, but he's been really supportive, and I feel like I've found a place. Same, I think, with another group like that, which is Daniel Levin's quartet, which is, like, more of a jazz-oriented thing. So I've been,
like, a drummerless band, right?
Like, yeah, it's chamber jazz, basically. I mean, I think he hates that term, but but it is kind of that. I mean, it's real heavy on the counterpoint, and without necessarily this kind of feeling of strong driving rhythm section. So, I mean, I feel, like, with the jazz stuff, I feel really lucky that people... There have been a handful of people that really not only believed in me, but, like, forced me to do it when I was not necessarily sure of it myself. And I've had a really strange relationship with jazz, because that's how I grew up. I still listen to jazz probably more than anything else. And when I'm practicing, if I have a lot of time to practice, I'm always practicing sets of changes and eighth note lines. And
right.
And it's always shocking to me a little bit when I do read reviews, which isn't that often anymore, but, like, when I do, that when people say that I'm not a jazz musician, because, like, to me, that's news to me, because that's what I consider myself. It's interesting this year, not only to, like, keep doing the work with Harris and keep doing the work with Daniel. This quintet record is actually my first jazz release as a leader ever, like, full-on jazz, you know,
right.
Rhythm section, quintet. You know, to tell you the truth, I'm completely scared to death of it. Like, I'm more afraid of this record than I've been of any other record. I feel like it's more of a risk than anything I've ever done. I mean, even some of the solo records of the record, the two records with Litton, which are really out, or the record with Fred Lomberg Holm and Jason Rebke, which I think was somewhat universally hated by the jazz press. Like, I'm more nervous about this. Yeah,
that's,
I know. Great. In a way, I like a, you know, part of me holds that near and dear to my heart, I have to say. But I'm more nervous about this record than anything else, because it actually has these touchstones that everybody can recognize as jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not scary when it's your thing and you know what your thing is. But when all of a sudden you're playing in a lineage...
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different things that you have to consider, and so I feel lucky to have had someone like Harris to kind of, like, help me ease back into that world through his music, which is so kind of open, and he allows me to kind of be a weirdo when I need to be, but still, we'll see. I don't ever expect to be in Downbeat, I guess. I should put it that way, but
his quintet, you know.
That's true. And Matt's quintet, too, playing with Matt's quintet, playing with your quintet recently. I mean, this has been an interesting year to really kind of live the dual life, which I haven't been able to do since I moved to New York, really, where I feel like I'm really playing jazz and I'm really doing my other stuff that I've been doing. So
right.
It's an exciting year for me. When I learn to accept it and embrace it, I think it'll be great.
It's interesting. I'm enjoying how much this jazz quintet vibes has been happening in these last few years.
Yeah.
Like Matt Bowder's group and Harris's band and your band. And I feel, you know, in all these things I hear echoes of different things. You know, Harris's band really calls to mind Miles's quintet, and Matt's music always, just because of some of the things he does on the tenor, always brings to mind some of these sort of blue note hard bop kinds
of
things.
Yeah, definitely.
And then your quintet really calls to mind it's the instrumentation thing, and you can't help but
sure,
think of Eric Dolphy's
yeah,
Out to Lunch.
Of course.
With, I mean, because you've got
Matt Moran on vibes.
And Jason, Josh.
Josh Sinton only playing bass clarinet.
Right.
And Ivan Dovsvik on bass and Harris playing drums. I mean, Harris told me when that band first started to play, he's like, every time someone's going to write about it, they're going to bring up Dolphy. And he's mm-hmm. like, are you sure you want to do that? Because that means they're always going to bring up Freddie Hubbard. And it's like, yeah, I mean, that adds to my fear. Because if they're going to compare you to someone, like, that's the last person I'd like to be compared to. Because, you know, that's like...
That guy's a
you don't want
monster.
It. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it was Booker Little or something, I would feel at least a little more akin to that. But I mean, that music, that was a big turning point for me. The Dolphy
yeah.
stuff, you know. I even came to that stuff after I'd been listening to late Coltrane and Ornette.
Mm.
But for some reason, I think the Dolphy thing, because the swing was so hard... And he played so strangely. Both he and Booker Little played so strangely over the swing.
Right.
That actually affected me more than like the freedom of Ornette, because it was guys that took a language and like made it a very personal thing. They didn't abolish the language; they just like put a completely different stamp on it. It's like when you listen. You know, we were talking before we turned the mics on about. Anthony Braxton playing standards. It's the same thing. Like
mm-hmm.
he just it's not that he's abolished a language, and it's not that he's tweaked a language. It's just that he's like completely sidestepped it and done this completely other thing. Or like if you listen to Axel Dörner play over swing, it's like bizarre.
Right.
And I love that more than anything else. Like Tony Fraschella or someone really strange that has like taken just a completely different route over the same material.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Dolphy for me is that. And that's kind of what that band's about. Like the quintet, my quintet, that's what it's about, is trying to like sidestep all that stuff. Dealing with tradition and dealing with swing, but and not abolishing it, but just kind of taking one step to the right or the left so that it's got a different vibe to it, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So that, as you were mentioning earlier, so that the people you're working with are surprised by what's going on.
Yeah.
Just as a player, you try to surprise the other people. As somebody that's organizing what's going on, as the band leader,
yeah,
you can accomplish that same sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my favorite part now of the... Every time the quintet plays the set of music we've been playing for a while is there's like one tune where there's like a 36-bar form... with tons of changes, like they're like weird warped Ladybird changes, and it's like a total West Coast kind of cool jazz thing, and playing over those changes because I know that no one in the band has ever heard me do that. Like even at this point, you know, it's like they're still
right.
shocked that I can play changes and not like freak out on them, you know.
Right,
and
right.
that's my favorite part, because it, to me too, it's like also something that
mm-hmm.
I don't do very often, so it's new to me, and I feel more like I'm actually inventing something over those changes than I do over kind of a free jazz gig where I know there's options to go into areas that I know will work, you know.
Right, yeah.
It's that period of really feeling like you're working with your wits, which I don't, you know, you have some of that sometimes and sometimes you don't.
Thank you. I remember you talking about Herb Robertson and the influence he had on you, and Herb Robertson and Ron Miles, in both in terms of their important roles that they played for you as trumpet heroes, as teachers, as role models, as colleagues.
Yeah, I think the direct influence I had more from Ron as a direct influence, because I was able to spend a number of years in Denver, at least around him. I wouldn't go so far to say that I studied with him, because I don't think he would want me to say that, in a way. Like, I took some lessons right when I moved there. I tried to get a hold of him as much as possible, and he was always really good about hanging out. But that's what we did. We hung out. Maybe we played, but more often than not, we listened to records and talked about what was up. But he was a profound influence on me, not only his playing. I mean, there's still a lot of his stuff in the way that I play. But his work ethic to me was huge. I mean, I've never met a trumpet player that is so calm about working so hard and constantly getting better and really not ever sitting on his laurels, like always thinking about how he can play differently and how he can play better. And he was huge for me in that way. Herbie, that's more of an influence from afar. I know him a little bit, and we've played together a couple times, and honestly, I would say every time we played, he's just completely crushed me, and it's been a beautiful experience to just get like smoked by Herb. But he was, I think, for a lot of players playing the way that I play, or in that generation of quote-unquote experimental or avant-garde or whatever you want to call it, trumpet players, I think Herb is a huge unsung hero. He's part of a group of unsung heroes. And not to take anything away from Dave Douglas, because I think he's a huge influence as well. I mean, for me, he continues to be a huge influence. And I don't think by his own doing, I think because of the way that the media perceived it at the time, he eclipsed a whole generation of players that have gone underappreciated. And I think Herb is definitely like a main figure within that. I think someone we both play with a lot, Dave Ballou,
yeah,
is woefully underappreciated. Paul Smoker,
yeah,
absolutely. Without Aaliyah Smith, even though he's obviously finally getting some recognition, and there's still, like, even beyond that, I mean, those are players that you can find in your record store, but there's people like Tom Gill and Ed Harkins on the West Coast. There was Rob Blakesley, was a huge influence, who sadly doesn't play anymore. It's just like this whole generation, and that's like a generation of players that were huge to me growing up in Oregon and like just picking up weirdo records where I could. We were talking at the very beginning about the amplified thing and the wanting to play, to have a raw, natural, uncomfortable, painful voice. That has always been what I connect with and what I feel comfortable playing and what I feel is my true natural voice as a trumpet player. And that is what Herb has. Herb plays like he talks, you know, to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally natural. It's totally honest. There's not anything disingenuous about the way Herb plays. And that, to me, is like the greatest lesson. Because there's a million, not just trumpet players, there's a million musicians out there that I find their music completely disingenuous when I hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, man, you hear Herb, and from note one, he's playing absolutely only what he should be playing. And he is playing absolutely the most honest music. Ron Miles, there's absolutely
yeah.
no bullshit in what Ron plays. Dave Ballou, same way, man.
Yeah.
And with Dave Ballou, it's more amazing to me because he plays so many notes. He can play so many notes.
Yeah.
And you know that he believes in every single note, that he knows what they are, and he could sing them, and it's what he's hearing in his head. It's
yeah.
not muscle memory, man. And
right.
that freaks me out. You know, a guy like Peter Evans is like that too. Taylor Hill behind him, like all these guys.
Yeah.
There's a generation now, and I'm really happy that to be included in it and that it's getting a certain amount of attention of really honest trumpet players.
This
you know, now you're yeah. getting this other generation who I think in a way is kind of getting, is being credited for some sort of trumpet revolution, which I don't really believe is true. I think the torch or the amount of information has picked up further down the line than people are used to. And there was kind of an information gap. It doesn't mean there weren't people doing that. It just means that they weren't being paid attention to in the same way they are now.
Things of various types and
yeah.
some of the more jazz oriented things. I mean, I've also seen you in some different contexts that are a little bit more contemporary notated music oriented. I mean, I remember there was a piece where you were sort of a soloist with the Antisocial Music.
Right, yeah.
And Anthony Braxton's Music for Brass. I mean, I've seen the Brass Quintet, and
right.
there was this great concert at St. Mark's Church where the first half was the Composition 103.
103, yeah, for seven trumpets.
And the other half was the Brass Quintet.
Yeah.
And you said that you have some more notated pieces that you're working on for your residency at Issue Project Room. I mean, how have you sort of viewed your operations in those worlds over the last few years?
As the years go by, I've become less and less comfortable playing notated music in a certain way. But I really enjoy the amount of work that goes into playing a notated piece of music. And I like that process. I like sitting with a piece of music for a really long time and figuring out how to make it work and coming up with solutions. Especially, you know, in all those cases, it's contemporary classical music, which almost always requires some sort of solution. That's the one side. I love doing it. And I feel like I'm not a complete idiot when it comes to that stuff. But at the same time, I also completely understand realistically where I stand in that world. You know, in a way, playing that stuff makes sense to me, but I really kind of view it almost as a well-meaning hobbyist. You know, like, I enjoy it. I'm never going to turn down, especially anything, like, if Anthony ever calls me for anything to play his music, right, notated or otherwise. And there are certain things that, you know, Elliot Sharp, for example, I would also never do that.
Never turn down anything that he
exactly,
asked.
Exactly. But at the same time, I understand. I'm the first to take myself out of a situation that I know that I'm not prepared to do. So that's kind of where I stand mm-hmm. with that. Now, the piece that we're doing for Issue Project Room is written by a friend of mine, Bojan Vuletic, who I've worked with for, I think, 8 years now, doing a lot of different things, pop records and theater pieces and all sorts of different stuff for him. But he's an amazing composer, and I know that he will write something that is just challenging enough to freak me out, but will use the language that I'm comfortable with. I mean, I don't think any composer knows what I do better than Bojan does. So,
and those are the people you work with.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, he's heard everything that I can do on the trumpet, and we'll figure out a way to make it natural. So, you know, that I feel a little more comfortable with. But it still will be a frightening
good,
experience,
good.
You know. But I think it'll be good.
You know, speaking of the work you've been doing as a band leader, it makes me think about some of the things you did early on when you first got here, where you were being a sideman in Andrew D'Angelo's band, and the things you did with Jack Wright. It seemed like, I remember talking to you at some point where you were trying to move away from doing as much sideman work.
Yeah.
A few years ago, like, you felt like you'd been doing too much of it and you wanted to focus more in on your own thing. I mean, taking a lot of, you know, like, different free jazz gigs and, you know, playing lots of random pickup things at CBGB's in the basement there, back in the when D-Pop's thing was going on. So it seems like you've gone through a cycle already, like doing that a lot when you first got here, and then focusing in, and then now with the things that you developed with your own, found your way back into these different projects of other people's things that, you know, where they're bringing out different aspects of what you do. I don't know, I'm curious how you felt about the period where you were just, you know, picking up all these gigs in town, just playing a lot with different
people. that was an amazing period. It was kind of dark for me too. I mean, like you said, you know, I think we talked about that. There were aspects of it that were amazing. Playing with Andrew D'Angelo was amazing.
Of course.
I mean, I wish that I played more with him now. I don't even get to see him that often for whatever reason, but I mean, that for me, playing in his band, which was a short-lived band but was amazing, was an incredible education. And I think he would probably kick my ass for using that word. Like, I don't know that he would want to be thought of as someone that educated the youth, but I mean, it was just, it was literally just getting your ass kicked, you know, and really having to come up, not only energy wise, but just creativity wise to someone like Andrew is incredibly hard. And the same with Jack in a different way. And unfortunately, I don't play with Jack that much anymore either. You know, and those two things were huge. And I would do those, you know, I would drop anything to play with those guys then. And I would do that now. But there was so much other stuff going on at that time. And I think everybody goes through this when they move to New York, where you're just going to take everything that someone gives you. If someone calls you up and says, it's a 19 person free jazz blowout session, you know, it's like five drummers, 13 sax players, and you, and there's no money and you're not going to get heard and you're going to be miserable, will you do it? You know, I'd say yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'd go and do it, and I'd be miserable, and I didn't really feel like I got anything out of it. But you know, you'd meet people, and that was important at the time. A couple things happened to me. I think I had some sort of weird break with that stuff at a certain point, when I just felt like I didn't know the reason that I was doing it anymore, and I wasn't getting any better. That was, I think, the main thing. I was actually getting worse as a trumpet player, I felt like. There were things that I wanted to do, you know, playing with Paul was a big thing. Playing with Joe Morris was a big thing. And playing solo. I mean, I know exactly when the breaking point was, actually. I played, and this doesn't reflect on either of the people that I was playing for, because it had nothing to do with them. I think it was just the point in time. But I played I think it was like 30 trumpet conduction of Butch Morris's for Dave Douglas. And
for the festival,
Festival of New Trumpet, it was one of the last things they did at Tonic. And it was 30 trumpet players on stage with Butch conducting. And
wild.
I walked out of there. And also, I think I have a real antagonistic, for better or worse, an antagonistic relationship with the music, quote unquote, scene and the business of music.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I feel lucky to be able to do the things I do, being so curmudgeonly about those sorts of things. And the combination of the music that night and the kind of business aspect of it afterward, I walked out the front door to Tonic without my trumpet and called my wife and said, I'm not going to play anymore. Like, I was going to quit. That was it. I couldn't do it anymore. And she luckily talked me down off that particular ledge. And, like, I walked back in and got my horn and went home. And, like, that was literally the point for me.
Wow.
Where that period that you're talking about ended. And the next period began. And, you know, who knows how much better my life would have been had I stayed on that path. But I'm happier now, and I play less gigs, but I play gigs that I'm happy with. Mm-hmm. And the sideman stuff, you know, I don't do a sideman gig that I'm not happy with, that I don't feel like I'm going to learn anything from. I think, I mean, you probably have come up against this too, but I think I've seen a lot of people that they know that's the path they have to take, is to, like, walk away, which is frightening, to, like, walk away from that and work on their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if their own thing is something that they feel like is going to get rejected by 75% of the people they've been playing with. And they don't do it. And I can understand why they don't. But for me... Why they don't walk away, yeah. But for me, had I not done it, you know, I think I'd be a miserable human being right now. I mean, I'm actually happy with my decision. And, you know, I guess that's where I am now. New York is a kind of brutal place, psychically, I think.
It's an interesting psychological environment to exist in. Like, there's something to rise above out of, you know, something very primal that yeah. one goes through.
Yeah, well, I think you have to know who you are, which is, you know, it's an easy thing to say, but it's something that's constantly changing.
Thank you. This is 10,000 Hours. My name is James Ilgenfritz, and my guest has been Nate Woolley.